Thank you, Catherine. That's the sermon that we needed for today. My daughter's family had blueberry muffins for breakfast one day last week. My four-year-old granddaughter, Emma, exclaimed, "Mama, we had these at church. They put them on the table. When the last song is over, everyone can have one. Remember? Remember?" To my granddaughter, church is blueberry muffins. Enough for everybody after the last song. And I wonder, what is it for you? What do you miss about this church? Might be a hymn that you've loved since you were a child. Might be a sermon on Bible verses that have challenged you or comforted you. It might be the praise songs that you're learning to love. It might be the fact that you can participate in your pajamas these days. What is it about this particular church, this church without walls, that you miss? My guess is that for most of you, it's the people. Now, that might be uncomfortable for some of you to admit, because isn't church about God? Isn't a Christian church about encountering Christ in the aisles and at the communion table? Yes, it is. And I asked last week for your sermon topics. You might be a little taken aback if you sent me an idea that I chose this particular scripture. No, I don't think that those of you who wrote in are struggling with demons. But I think right now, it's just as tough. And I think that, to be fair, when I offer hope or encouragement, I need to acknowledge the other side as well. I learned that lesson during the season of Advent quite a few years ago. Chris Ewing Weiss offered this in her Advent reflections. Advent, she says, gives us an opportunity to break through the veneer of business as usual, to feel to the bottom of the quiet desperation that often underlies ordinary life, as well as to give voice and hope to those whose world may be actively coming apart. To preach Advent, she says, is to stop pretending that everything is fine. To preach coronavirus is to stop pretending that everything is fine. I don't know about you, but sometimes my mind isn't satisfied with figuring out how to do streaming better. My spirit isn't satisfied with offering a sermon to empty seats. My heart yearns for things today, not in some safer tomorrow. And sometimes I think I shouldn't feel that way. The heart of my faith is hope. Hope in resurrection and forgiveness and transformation and healing. But I want to be real about this today and give voice to some of our sadness. You know, our new unofficial theme song, Rise Up, says, "All we need, all we need, all we need is hope. And for that, we have each other." And here's the truth. Right now, we don't have each other. Not in the way we're used to, not in the way we need, not in the way that I pray we will never again take for granted. So for today, I want to remind you to be gentle with yourself. On the first day of our streaming services, I shared this, a soft reminder as we enter a new week, written by Lisa Oliveira. We, all of us, are currently going through a collective traumatic experience. Trauma is often thought of as too much, too fast, which is exactly what's happening. Of course you're exhausted. Of course you're afraid. Of course you're overwhelmed. Of course you're clinging to certainty in the midst of so much unknown. Of course you aren't as productive, feeling foggy, or wondering how you can possibly go through so many waves of emotion all in the same day. This all makes sense in the context of our circumstances. Be gentle with yourself. Have compassion for your process. Give yourself grace. You are good, no matter how you are managing this completely new experience. In light of her words and all that we're going through, I'm going to offer three reminders today, three reminders about the need to be kind and compassionate with yourself during this time. First, a reminder about human needs. Many of you are familiar with Maslow's hierarchy of needs. Simply stated, Maslow's hierarchy asserts that human beings have five levels of need. First, physiological needs for oxygen, for food, for water, for shelter. Second, safety needs. Third, the need for love, affection, and belonging. Fourth, the need for esteem, both self-respect and respect from others. And fifth, the need for self-actualization, which Maslow describes as a person's need to be and do what the person was born to do. A musician must make music. An artist must paint. A poet must write. Right now, many of us, those of us here bringing you the service and those of you who are a part of it through technology, most of us have that first level. We have food, water, shelter. But then we get to the second one, safety. And bam! We haven't got that. And if you picture Maslow's hierarchy as a ladder with rungs far apart, you can't move from one to five if any of those steps are missing. But right now, there's a yawning chasm where step two should be, and kind of where step three should be. Love and belonging. Many of us are struggling right now. You belong at your church, on your team. You belong with your coworkers. You see, we're struggling right now with our belonging. And we're trying to make do. And so maybe we're not struggling every moment, maybe not every day, maybe not even most days. But sometimes. And it's hard. And second, we have no idea when this time will end. There's a story about a platoon of Israeli soldiers who were required to make a forced march. They were divided into four groups, and the four groups were not allowed to communicate with one another. Each group marched over the same terrain on the same day with the same backpack. Group one was told the exact distance they had to go, which was 25 miles, and they were kept fully informed about how far they had traveled. Group two was not told how long the march would be and were not informed regarding the distance that they had already traveled or the distance they had left. Group three was originally told that they would march 20 miles, but at the last moment, they were told they were expected to march more miles. And group four was told they had to go twice as far as the first group, but they were stopped about halfway there. All four of these groups ended up marching the same distance, but they marched with different knowledge about the exact distance and about the duration of the route. Doctors measured the effects of the march in terms of morale, performance, and change in body chemistry, especially hormones that were believed to elevate as stress mounted. And here are the results. Group one, with complete knowledge of how far they had to go and constant updates, showed the least evidence of stress. They had the highest degree of hopefulness. Group two, those who were not told how far they had gone or how far they had yet to go or how far they would be going when they set out, group two fared the worst in all post-march measurements. Group three, which originally thought it would march only 20 miles and then was expected to march more, was discouraged, but they weren't as emotionally wrecked as group two. And group four, whose 50-mile march was cut to 25 in the end, showed high levels of stress and were clearly demoralized, but they did not suffer like group two. It's the not knowing how long, the not knowing exactly when it will be safe to go back to some kind of normal, that is so hard right now. And third, there's compassion fatigue, not the kind we usually talk about taking care of each other, about taking care of elderly parents or children with special needs, not that, but something much bigger. Nicholas Kristof has won two Pulitzer Prizes covering some of the world's worst atrocities. He covered the Tiananmen Square massacre in China. He covered genocide in Darfur. Here is part of his story. Kristof realized that many of the issues he cared deeply about were not being addressed simply because they never made it onto the agenda. He decided that shining a spotlight and making people uncomfortable about what they see in that spotlight is the first step toward getting resources devoted to the issues that we care about. He first put that theory into practice after his experience in China covering the Tiananmen Square demonstrations and the massacre that resulted. He was there in Tiananmen Square. He was revolted by what he saw. For weeks, every story that he wrote was about that massacre, and it appeared on the front page of newspapers. But then the next year, he came across a study indicating that every year in China, 39,000 baby girls were dying because they didn't get the same food and health care as the boys. He had given hundreds of column inches to hundreds of deaths, and not one column inch to 39,000 baby girls dying each year. He began to think that his journalistic priorities were too narrowly focused on what was happening in the government, in political life. But at the same time, he began to worry that the kinds of statistics he was finding were debilitating, that instead of urging people to action, they might actually paralyze people. He became fascinated with the science behind his theories, with the social psychology and the neurology of all of this. In the meantime, as he began to study what was behind this, there appeared in New York City a red-tailed hawk named Pale Mail. Pale Mail was living in a condo building on Central Park. He was evicted by the building, and New Yorkers were up in arms about this homeless red-tailed hawk. Kristoff was frustrated that he couldn't get the same reaction from people for hundreds of thousands of people being driven out of their homes as he could get for one red-tailed hawk. So that led him to looking further into the work of neurology and social psychology and what makes people care about things. He knew that there's compassion fatigue as the number of victims increases, but what the research has shown is that the number at which compassion fatigue begins to set in is 2. He began studying the work of psychologist Paul Slovic. There were experiments where people were shown a photo of a starving girl from Mali called Rokia, a 7-year-old girl, and they were asked to contribute in various different scenarios. And then they were shown a boy named Musa, and essentially, people would donate a lot of money when they were told the plight of Musa. And they would donate a lot of money when they were told about Rokia and her hunger. But the moment you put the two children into the same brochure, the moment you showed people pictures of the two children at the same time, their donations dropped drastically. And by the time you asked people to donate to 21 million hungry people in West Africa, nobody wanted to contribute at all. And now the whole world is in danger. We are used to having some safe place to go when the hurricane comes, when the earthquake, the tsunami hits. We're used to having some safe place to go, and now there's no safe place. It's more than overwhelming. Last week, somebody who loves me very much said, "Pastor, you're not as funny as you used to be. You need to tell more jokes." Well, here's the truth. The only thing more difficult than telling a joke in a room full of people is telling a joke in a room empty of people. I miss you all. I'm not myself without all of you. And some of you I know are thinking, "That's a problem, Pastor, because God should fill all your empty places. Jesus should fill all your empty places, Pastor." I understand where you're coming from. And I at one time thought that for myself, but I miss you. And my problem is not that I love you too much or that I don't love Jesus enough. I miss you because I love you like I'm supposed to and like you're supposed to love me back and like we're supposed to love one another. The theologian Tertullian, writing at the end of the second century, nailed it. He said, "See how these Christians love one another." And Jesus was always clear about his expectations. "This is my commandment, that you love one another just as I have loved you." Right now, it's like we're not even ourselves. Because we're not together. It's like a piece of our body is missing. It's worse. It's like we're a piece of the body and everything else is missing. And that's why I saved part of today's gospel story till the end. Listen to how the story ends. As Jesus was getting into the boat, the man who had been possessed by demons begged him that he might go with him. But Jesus refused and said to him, "Go home to your friends and tell them how much the Lord has done for you and what mercy he has shown you." And the man went away and began to proclaim in the Decapolis how much Jesus had done for him. And everyone was amazed. I chose this story for two reasons. First, in so many stories of Jesus' healing, you hear these words, "Go in peace. Your faith has made you well." Your faith has made you well. You did not hear those words in this morning's story. It was a story about grace, absolute grace, healing, compassion, love shown by Jesus. Not asked for, not healed because of great faith. I want you to remember, especially during this time, that you don't even have to feel good enough to ask for help. You don't have to take anything on yourself, and you don't have to worry that your faith is insufficient. It's okay to be struggling right now. And here's the second reason I chose this story. The man who was cured said to Jesus, "Let me go with you. I'm healed. You healed me. You are all I need." And Jesus said, "No. Go back to your people. Go back to your friends and tell them what I have done for you." Friends, we are needing our village. We're needing our people. There is nothing about the gospel of Jesus Christ that has room in it for social distancing. Nothing about it that has room for us to be living separate lives away from one another. The church cannot be the church and socially distance. Now, don't worry that I'm becoming reckless or encouraging that we rush out of our homes, take off our mask, and begin to hug one another. I am not. But I am advocating that we understand that though physical distancing is necessary right now, we cannot survive social distancing. We cannot survive spiritual distancing. And just like we are always disproportionately impacted by any disease, by any illness of society, we are also disproportionately, inequitably impacted by staying at home. It is necessary for those of us who are not lonely for the moment to reach out to those who are. And it is incumbent upon those who are to let the rest of us know. Here's what I think. We need to be making blueberry muffins for each other. Every day, metaphorically, and sharing them with each other metaphorically, until we can put them on the table. And after the last song, everybody can have one.